From the Coffee Shop Gallery downtown Vermilion, South Dakota, on a cold and wintry evening beneath the stars. This is January 2008's edition of the Vermilion Literary Project Poetry Slam podcast. My name is Douglas Brennelson, and I'll be your podcast host for this exceptional program featuring highlights from the Poetry Slam conducted on Thursday, January 31st, which started at 7 p.m. The names and titles of the featured poets and their poems will be listed on this podcast page and numbered in the order they appear. This particular podcast was initiated by the evening's sacrificial poet, USD's very own Leanne Rorpo, who read several new original poems, as well as one previously published poem, Octopus in the Freezer, from her award-winning book, Year of the Snake, published in 2004 by the Southern Illinois University Press. Leanne's full program of poetry readings will be presented as an additional bonus podcast to this Poetry Slam because of its rich and rewarding value, as well as to exercise our deep appreciation and the honor of being able to present it to you exclusively here first. So, on with the Vermilion Literary Project's January 2008 Poetry Slam and round one of our poetry competition.
She was a complete stranger to me. She was kind. Darkness was descending. It was difficult to see. In a micro-minute of time, the harsh, gray, graveled pavement of Walmart was in my face, smacking my defensive palms, scraping my arthritic knees, red, bruised, blood seeping free. She jumped out of an SUV. Her long, silky brown hair swung around her white moon face, concerned, as she gently lifted me. She pointed to a thick, gnarly pumpkin stem lying malevolently nearby, the culprit, an overlooked remnant of Halloween left by the pumpkin cleanup crew. As I limped around Walmart, I wanted to sue, but I decided a good thing I could take away from the lessons of this pavement encounter was the humble remembrance of the kindness of a stranger. She was kind.
As the clock strikes 10, she walks into the room, and for a moment, unnoticed is she, until the scent of her perfume spreads through the air, and the sound of her voice captures me. And for a second, I wonder where she's been all my life. And I've longed for a moment like this. And then I close my eyes, and I start to lust for but one single, solitary kiss. A kiss of such passion, a kiss with such grace. This, in my vision, I see. And then in reality, her lips do touch mine. Ever so gently.
We do this to simulate the function of digestion. She was stolen and became the whites of her eggs. Often, she thinks of the first automaton duck, how the defecation pellets were hidden away beforehand. Now she reaches her back and pulls out stacked rings of washers lined with her own plasma, even before they were placed inside of her, to weigh down her hooks for colder fish, as she tells her lovers. She remembers it all, even when NASA tinted her red so others would find her uninhabitable, even when she was placed with the little ones whose parts looked similar to hers. They told her she once was a cuckolded blacksmith and asked her what mobile string was that day most like the emotion, love. She sits. Her arms seem more shaved of cells. Ladies know she eats corn. They cover her with sheets.
Remembering you is like wondering what happens to my garbage after the big truck takes it away. Do those food wrappers ever think of me? Are those beer bottles seeing anyone special? Have the banana peels finally moved on? Who cares? I left the dump because it sucked.
Channeling Charles Bukowski. I've been reading Charles Bukowski for days. While the mail went in and the mail went out, and the sun went up and the sun went down, and the foods went in and the foods went out, and I waited for your letter. Reading Charles Bukowski. And your letter finally came, and I didn't write back because then I'd have to wait again for your response. And then I found the courage to be normal, and I wrote to you. And now I'm not waiting, and I'm wondering what that's about. But the waiting, it will come back, and I can fill the space with what I do and what I must, and I'll find the gap where the world is blank and my thoughts are blank and the moon and the sun hang in the sky, and the only break in stillness is the rise and the fall of my own breath. But the waiting will return. In the meantime, I'll look for the raw truth of the world in the words of Charles Bukowski, who drank too much and abused himself because that's what he had to do to feel alive, and I get that. It would be so easy to find that place. but hell to maintain. And I'm amazed that Charles Bukowski never killed himself, or maybe he did, just a slow death, just slow enough to get past the twisted turn of his sex, the dark and the ugly, the beautiful trap of his fate. And I think I would have been one of those women who waited for Charles Bukowski, who waited to appear in the lines of his life, and maybe wanted to change him, clean him up. But he couldn't stand the ones who took his filth away. That would be me, waiting and being an annoyance to Charles Bukowski. And I'm not getting cynical sitting here reading Charles Bukowski for days. Quite the opposite, in fact. I'm looking for the truth in gutters, in paper bags, in the spaces between the flakes of the snow, and in the way the water on the sidewalks dries to draw irregular shapes of rectangles and squares. I can see him there in those loose squares, drinking and smoking and digging deep into the bowels of his darkness for the truth, for something. And in this way, he enters me and stays. And in this way, I quarter the longing of waiting for your words and not waiting for your words. And in this way, I'm channeling Charles Bukowski.
So, I fell into the whole rap thing. It's not a half-assed act thing, or a trying-to-be-black thing. It's my simple fascination with syllable stacking paced at rates that race across the pages into rhythmic whiplash statements arranged as a creation not contained within the nature of our daily chit-chat language. But at the risk of exaggeration, let me say this. Shit is dope. Consider it the resonance of Memphis in me. Been 9 years, but those side effects were extended release, bubbling up from my iron gut, dispensed through a set of bent teeth. One of my expressive loopholes, my true hopes spewed in syncopated blue notes, penetrating deep like U-boats, my views cloaked in shrewd quotes, not fool's gold. Thanks. It isn't just the verses showboating with the gimmicks, it's the first kick drum to that last little sentence. When I first saw it, the beats rumbled under me and I couldn't feel anything but the beat. I'm sorry. Swear the rest of my frame, hypnotized by those breaks and the noises they make. The noises from the beatbox extraordinaire to the turntablist zeroing in on a record's sweet spot, extracting tricks from vinyl once he takes the sleeve off, making music with music, scratching, sequencing, sampling, truning, slicing, tapping, chopping, reversing, fixing, discarding, erasing, stretching, punching, whatever it takes to get the floorboards bumping for that demographic of cats who think they're onto something. And we are. And every argument or condescending remark isn't a strike against this fraction of my art. And every giggle and snicker and rolled eyeball, every whispered criticism to your friend about how he's trying to be like so-and-so, every confused stare due to my pigment, just makes me dig what I dig more. Where else can you slang, let your ego off the hook? So, forgive me if I spit when I spit, but I'm sort of hip to this, not discouraged when I notice other people aren't as into it. To tell the truth, there's one trait possessed by those cats who want to rap. We all think we're ill or sick, like we're hypochondriacs. Thank you.
And that final poem of round one marks the end of round one for the Vermilion Literary Project's Poetry Slam. And now we begin round two.
Dress yourself in my ferocity, Castle King. My granite tongue and marble fangs drip with Komodo dragon spit. Plead with warnings to minions of evil. Demons commit honorable suicide in the terrible furrows of my war face. Serpents of temptation go belly up in the shadow of my wingspan. Ghosts and ghouls banished by the vigilance of a stone soldier. But when enemies arrive from human lands, rock breakers, wall smashers, pawns, verily the bane of brick masons, foes not armed with limitless misanthropy. I'm silent. I'm stone. I'm as vulnerable as you.
The times you've come and haven't to my house. There was the first time, the times painstakingly recorded from start to finish when I noticed your eyes were the color of blueberries. They've never been that color to me since, but I wrote about it and I have it here somewhere. There was the time when we sat on the south patio all night long. I fed you homemade granola with organic milk and showed you the Briarcliff Review, the one that had published my poem called The Sexiest Thing. But I didn't mention it, nor did you. You just handed it back without saying anything. Then there was a time a crowd of us walked to the Firefly Bridge at 2 a.m. and you rested your arm on the bridge just close enough to mine that the hairs on our arms mingled. You tried to sneak us away from the crowd so we could recite our poems to one another. The one of mine, you said, you had read in the Briarcliff Review. I wondered if you had purposely saved this moment. We barely got to yours, the one I thought was about losing Thea. I remember the night we made trips between my house and TJ's, and I told you I had a crush on you, and you asked me if I ever wore trousers under my skirts, and I figured you liked that, so I put some on. Then there was the night we took the alley to my house, and you leaned against the row of metal garages and kissed me way down on my throat, slowly and deliberately, turning me around to hold the back side of me against you. I heaved and sighed under the weight of your circular hands. But I soaked up your mechanics all too soon, and that collapsed my desire like a punctured balloon. You probably didn't understand me. You probably later called me a tease. There was also the time I tried to pin you down on New Year's Eve. Were you just fucking with me, or did you actually feel something? Let's dance, not talk, was your reply. And then there was a night we spent together recently, you again with your head just barely in your pants. But did you know l'art d'arrangerci, the art of making something out of nothing? Could you, as I have done in the lines of these pages, turn a few simple, maybe even flawed, ingredients into a feast? Was your way of prolonging pleasure enough to give up the potential and make it an act? You closed your eyes. One time. We could just do this one time. Two nights ago, you delivered two paintings when I was out with friends, and I walked into the kitchen, and there you were. I mean, your paintings were there, and I tried to find some other sign of you, something you had moved or touched, disturbed or investigated. Had you taken my bathing suit from the floor and placed it on the table? I drew it to my face and took in its sweet and briny scent. Did you remove and sharpen the pencil from the jar on the sill, or had you found it that way? Did you fold the list of menu items you used for your note, or had I? Did you pick up the picture of me and Rick on the day of John and Carol's marriage and my son was conceived and dissect its story? I wondered what parts of my life you had gathered in the brief moments you were in my house. I noticed then how I, or someone, had placed yours and Thea's BFA postcards side by side on the fridge, separated only by a Savory Times magnet. And I wondered if you had noticed that too.
I've tried. But I see no culture in my complexion. Well, I know four things attributed to my heritage, but the truth is, I don't care enough about Lefse or Lutefisk. And the blonde hair and blue eyes don't make me look to the Atlantic fjords pointing to my origin, their origin. I've never been. I'm of the VHS, original Nintendo, cassette tape, pencil sharpening, dysfunctional family American generation. Colorless, cultureless, valueless. Don't mistake this as identity hatred. I'm not a naysaying do-nothing or a flag-waving patriot. It's just my pride's vacant. I see something to be desired. I learned that tradition holds a bulkier lifespan across different spots in this spinning magical coincidence on which everything we've ever done or ever dreamed will sleep forever. I see the family-centric compassion in Mexico when I want it. Quiero esta cultura. While learning their beautiful rhythmic language, I see affection that we don't have. Lessons we could learn, like when I observed an older coworker, Gustavo, respond to the arrival of his niñas. Didn't matter how busy we were, he dropped everything, wiped the work from his hands onto his apron, and scooped them both up in a frantic, swirling embrace, kissing each one before trying to set them down, which involved prying their clasped little fingers from around his neck. That was every day I ever worked with him for a year and a half. This is that tearjerker moment in the movie where people hide their faces. This is that type of connection I'd like to have to fight to escape. The expressions, those wavy, rolling R's, the flow of their sentences chopped up by sharp accents, feminine and masculine words softened or hardened with either an A or an O, I find it fascinating. And J.R.R. Tolkien can wave from beneath the earth's crust about the sparkling beauty of cellar door, but that doesn't hold a candle to words like mariposa, caballo, lindissima. And what have we got? Internet predation, energy drinks, drive-thru marriages, pornography, survivor, big dick pills and the griddles. I'd just like to have one simple family moment where no one's in a hurry because everyone's already there. If I knew what that was like, I'd stop having to try to imagine. If I knew how that felt, I could ease up and unwind my tendency to cling with hulking apprehensions to everyone I love. If I knew, I wouldn't have to publicly wish for a second that I'd been raised somewhere else or in a different lifetime. Quiero saber. I want to know.
This is called Journey. Part one, adolescent anger. I see people who have painted stained glass windows on their eyes. They see the red sun rising, but they cannot see the lies, for they have chosen to live as part of the disguise. They see mountains as horizons and untruths as alibis, but they can't be free. I've met people who feel through programmed sensors in their brains. They have built their walls around them in the way that they were trained, because it's safe and deceitful. In their prisons they remain, where their love is secret hatred, and accomplishment is shame, and they can't be free. Part two, lost. Nowhere to go, but I'll find some place to be. Tomorrow's a long time away. It doesn't matter much to me. The wind blows, it blows, and I'll follow it. I'll follow it out to the sea. And I listen to the seagulls crying, screaming their anger because life is too hard to live. Worthless, the sunshine seems hollow. Go far away, hide away, and forget how to give. Moon, the moonshine is silver, gliding, ruling in wonder. Look closer, you'll find just a big rock, scarred and torn and plundered. Go far away, fly away, hide away, and reject how to live. God help me, is this all there is? Part three, found. A ghost from the past floats down to my brain, an idea, a thought. The way I used to be, and it seems so strange, so distant. What once was so clear and easy to understand in its sharp and rigid way is now so blurred and softened. It doesn't mean anything anymore. No, it's still as meaningful as ever. Only the visions inside of me have changed. What once was a narrow path, a struggle of living lined with thorns, has now turned into a wide flowing river blessed with possibility.
All right, this one's called A Picture of My Doghouse. In my hand, I hold a picture. It's faded from the sun. Like a familiar pair of blue jeans, it comforts me to see. In this picture, there is a house of yellow rusted tin, worked by the steady hands of time, as though built by the Creator himself. Some may call it a doghouse, yet I have called it home, where anger cannot find me or strip me of my dignity. She can say she sent me there, but it lets me feel secure, like a hot cup of tea on a dampened day, topped with cinnamon spice. And this year I have seen it not, but would gladly take it in, for it could rest upon my porch, and I would not turn it away.
All the host of them. I light the gasoline with dry umbilical cord. The coccyx is still your tailbone. All the good that comes from the rounded edges of your apartment, prove it. Because the reptilian brain is alive on the coffee table with all the walnut shells, I feel preverbal with all the host of them. Your neighbor, she's tall enough to walk over a turnstile. She waters tomatoes all day. I sign that the spice rack is disassembled. Nothing touches the walls. The woman in the doorway, she moves to drop younger nuts in vinegar. She asks, is that a dimple or a scar? Your stomach expands, and I must remove my shoes or be killed. I watch them go back, move the thumbtack, and pour barium onto your rice. But before you can eat, I open your mouth and pull out warm nutmeg and count to nativity. You phone a vision, me as blue and on a throne with my hand inside you while two beings watch. I want to tell you, as a child you cried during tests of the emergency broadcast system. You ask me, is my call coming from inside the house?
So here are the standings. The third place winner was Laurie Johns. Second place winner was Taylor G. And first place winner was Brandon Johnson, who now reads a victory poem.
And that doesn't seem like a big deal to me, but it throws people off. So I sympathize with anyone who's got a unique name with those unique parents. Hi, Mom. B-R-A-N-D-Y-N. Pronounced Brandon. Don't let the Y throw you off. Something about subtle parents dabbling in the subtlety of taking a regular name and tweaking it around. Nice and unique, they say, never considering the illiteracy of substitute teachers and telemarketers. Not to mention the cruelty of a sixth grade class watching a boy get called a girl's name. Brandy? No. As it turns out, neither N is silent. Brayden? No, the Y comes after the D. Brandolin? No, there just isn't an L. I don't know how you shimmied that in there, but no. So my parents wanted to name me Brandolin, but there were people to put more thought into it, I suppose. So now I meet others with comedian parents. There's more generations of pre-butchered names. I met a Graven, a Dylan, a Beth, and an Ian with two E's instead of an I. As poor kids, we can't really avenge being punchlines, so that tends to trickle down the family tree. And what about all the Shafeeds in the country? The poor Shafeeds. That's S-H-I-T-H-E-A-D. Shafeed. They're probably retired substitutes who discover shithead on their class roster. So forget Goofy, check out my novelty zany names. What about pretty names? What about the Cheyennes and the Lilies and the Clementines? No more pilot inspectors and please, no more blankets. Name names after names. And please, also, no more Lorelei's. No more kids' names after stick songs. If there's anything your kid will hate more than your music, it'll be known if they're named after your favorite cheesy bullshit song. So when I'm a father, and if I notice kids' names are just getting nuttier and nuttier, I'm going to name my firstborn Cream, which, for those of you that don't know, stands for Cash Rules Everything Around Me, Cream Get the Money, Dollar Dollar Bill, y'all. And when he or she gets into trouble, and I scream that full name across the neighborhood cul-de-sac, I hope they don't discover that I wasn't so clever, because by then there's 15 other kids rocking out the same acro name. And I don't know this much about having a little Y in my name, but I'd be completely nuts if my name was Fogelberg or AC/DC. Thank you.
And that concludes the January 2008 Vermilion Literary Project Poetry Slam podcast. This is Doug Brennelson, and I'll see you again next month.